Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back. Another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here to have another conversation that I'm hoping helps your business grow. Look, so many of you have started a business and now you're trying to figure out what to do with it. It's not uncommon. So many of you want to start a business and you're trying to figure out how to actually do that. The biggest problem that you have to figure out is how to start creating value, not only in your own company, but also with the future clients or relationships that you need to have, whether you're B2B, B2C, any of that. You have to start figuring that out now. So, as usual, I have brought in someone to help me get to the bottom of how we're going to create value early. Now, I mentioned I've got someone with me today that's going to help us get to the bottom of how we create value early. So let's go ahead and say hi to Sansi Hanal, the co-founder of Qualla. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to talking about this. You know, Sansi is a multi startup founder. She's been down the road before, but no one will let us know more about her backstory better and more effectively than Sansi. So straight out of Amherst, New Hampshire, where it's probably already freezing cold. Sansi, welcome. Let's hear a little bit about your background.
Sure. It is getting cooler. I have two jackets on the back of my chair already, although I've never done really well with the very cold weather, but I'm prepared. So a little bit about me or my background. I've spent the last, almost my entire career, but specifically the last 15-ish years in startups and working primarily with early stage companies. My first company was in the retail space. I know you have specific experience in retail as well, working with SMBs. We grew that business to about $1 million in ARR, and I learned and cut my teeth on what it was like to start a company that had $0 in revenue and no real understanding of what the offering would be. I think as founders, we all have hunches on the value that we want to provide. And then as we have conversations in the field, we learn how to evolve that idea into something that people love, find value, and will pay for. And it was really through that experience that I fell in love with entrepreneurship. I was dealing with a cohort of entrepreneurs in retail where they had put it all on the line, many of them, to start their own companies. And I was fascinated by this group of people that had a dream, thought that they could better the world in their own unique way, and went after it. And I was obsessed with supporting them in that effort. So that was my first experience. I got a taste and I thought, you know what? I'm never going to do anything else with my life. So with my second company, I know some people get a taste and they're like, yeah, I'm done.
I tell people I'm completely unemployable. So yeah, it's similar, very similar.
Yeah. I fell in love with the, well, there are so many things I'm sure we'll get to them, but the sort of autonomy, the radical accountability, and the high that comes with knowing that no one else is going to come in and save you. It's up to you to make this work. Again, particularly within the very, very early stages. While I was there, I met my co-founders for the next company that I started called Promobox, two X's. We're based in Boston. We are a Techstars 2011 company. I don't know if anyone listening is familiar with many of the startup accelerators in tech that are out there, although many of them have branched out of tech, but primarily in tech. One of them is Techstars. We were accepted in the 2011 class, and Promobox is a marketing technology platform that we built because of our experiences with the previous company. So it was for manufacturing brands and their independent retailers to help them essentially co-market together online. And that was a wild decade of my life. I turned around and 10 years had passed. I don't know how that happens, but it taught me about intentionality when it comes to deciding where you're going to spend your time, because you blink and it's, you know, a year has passed. So we grew that business to, let's see, about 15 people on my team specifically, around 70 people overall at Promobox. We had 100 enterprise level customers and about 50,000 SMBs that we worked with. And I got to experience what it was like to connect with brands like General Motors and General Electric, and also Patagonia and Arc'teryx and New Balance, and around, I think it was 12 or 14 different industries. And then I left, and out of my experiences at Promobox, leading the customer-facing teams there, again, growing that company from $0 to $10 million, I started the company that I've co-founded today and currently working on, called Koala, and it's a play on the qualitative. And it helps customer success teams that are relationship-focused customer success teams working with their customers day in and day out to track not only how their customers are using their platforms, but also keep their eye on the opportunity balls that allow them to expand business while driving success for the overall company. So that's what I'm doing today. And I'm really excited to be here and talk. Hopefully I can provide some value around what the last 15 years have looked like and been like for me in startups.
It's funny because startup years are like dog years, you know, and it's like 10 years of startup history. That's like 78 real human years, which is like an average lifespan. And the question is why? Well, that's because it's stressful and it puts you through the ringer. Now, one of the things that the subject of today's episode of Startup Hustle was once again presented by Crown CFO. Thank you for Crown, because that's an example of providing value. You either need to be working on creating value, you have to be seeking value, or you have to be offering value. So this is some of the things. Obviously, your current company, Koala, which is spelled Q-U-A-L-A. .io, mm-hmm. And you can find a link for that in the show notes. It helps with some of that, but let's keep it a little bit general. So where are some of the places that in your own history or your own experience or just what you've come across, where do you think startups begin to, where do you think they need to create value the most early?
Such the, you know, frankly, $1 billion question or $1 million question. Yeah. So I think, just to take a step back, what's so important, and I was taught this early on, and I continue to learn this lesson, is that us as founders, we have our own unique experiences. Like the experiences that I had at Promobox directly contributed to the work that we're doing at Koala. So I have my own view on things. I have the value that I want to create as a result of building this technology with my co-founder and our team. And you can really get tunnel vision when you're thinking about the value that you want to provide. And someone advised me way back when, and I think about this often, that, you know, founders really get obsessed with their own ideas. And it's hard for us sometimes to envision another world and be flexible as the market or field tells us, hey, what you thought you might be providing that's important, actually, this is a way more interesting angle of something we would pay for. So just to give you an example, for us at PromoBox, as we were thinking about this in the early days, we actually launched a platform that allowed small business owners to run sweepstakes campaigns on Facebook. That was it. It was $99 a pop, every campaign. And we quickly realized that that was going to be a really difficult play for us. And as we had conversations with more and more SMBs, or specifically independent businesses, we found that just in general, getting marketing content that was value and helpful to their business was hard. And they thought, you know, the biggest way for us to get this type of content that would power our business is from the brands that we sell. And that started to give us the idea of what would a world look like where the, you know, there wasn't this fraction, you know, this difficult, disjointed experience for consumers when they're visiting a manufacturing brand's website and then go to purchase from a local independent retailer. With Koala, it's for us, you know, it's originally when we started the company, we thought maybe this idea of amassing a great amount of qualitative data to understand overall health of companies, well, that actually started with overall health of employees. When we first launched our platform, we thought, is there a way to help managers better connect with what their employee is thinking and feeling about their job? Do they have the autonomy that they need? Do they have the resources that they need? Are they happy with the work that they're doing? And we quickly realized that actually this is something that we want to understand about our customers. And then when we started shopping the idea, we realized, okay, this is something customer success teams would pay for that's hugely valuable to them. So we talk about generating value. I know we have our own ideas of what that looks like. It's important that we hold really loosely to that. I'm sure you've experienced this, you know, you have so much experience where hold loosely to that, be flexible and have as many conversations as possible with your potential customer and get a sense of, is what you're actually pitching something that's really interesting to them that they would actually, you know, pay for, which that's really important. So I think for us, when you're thinking of generating value, start at the source, have those conversations, and then don't always jump to the solution. Really think about, is the value that I'm providing something that's going to resonate with my cohort?
I have some firsthand experience with this. I'll throw myself under the bus because when we were building Gigabook, I went through this. And you know, one of the things is we thought that, so Gigabook's online booking, and, you know, we've been around for a while, and it first came out, we thought, I really just, because I'm kind of an efficiency nerd, like business inefficiency, I find it weirdly, like it's painful for me to really wrap my arms around. So I thought people would be really excited to find value and the efficiency that online booking and invoicing and different stuff would provide. And I mean, long story short, very quickly realized that our users found way more value in the peace of mind that it offered. And that was like one of those weird things that you can't, it's a tangible and tangible, you know, because you can't put a price on peace of mind. What's that worth to someone else? And it turns out that our users were really, they it wasn't the efficiency they wanted. They wanted to unchain themselves from all the return phone calls, the ones that come in at 11 at night, text messages, all this different stuff. So, you know, I think it's got to start for, if you're going to create value early, you have to start by really broadening your view and defining mm-hmm. what is value. And I mm-hmm. think one of the things that you hit on that was, it's so vitally important to that, is talking to the users. So, you know, and if you've listened for a while, you've heard me tell this story before. But there's this old story about a shopkeeper that's so busy cleaning the store that he never gets around to opening it. Mm. And you can do the same thing with your platform or your business. And I've been taking notes lately here as we record, which is the next step in evolution for me as a podcast host, by the way, Santi, just so you know.
Wonderful.
It's mainly so I can write down all the great things you say and maybe later take credit for them as my own brilliant ideas. But I put a note down here that said head down, product focused. This is a common issue and problem that you find in early stage companies. You get founders that, well, okay, so you might have two, if you have a tech company, you might have a couple people that they're so focused on the tech that they never lift their heads up. And you're right there, you are already the shopkeeper. You're not opening the store. You're not talking to the potential user. You're not creating value around the relationships that you may want down the road. Now, here's the thing is you got to start doing that early. If you want to provide value for your startup in the earliest stages, then you need to start selling what you do or building the relationships like almost before day one. Because relationships, much like people dating and getting married, well, in most cases, don't happen immediately. Oh, you got to get to know, you got to find a potential suitor, you get to know them. And if you find yourself rushing into that, then you're just like someone you knew. Everyone knows someone that proposed to someone or did something wild like 2 weeks in, and then they realize a month later, they're like, oh, idea. But business is the same thing. And is that part of what you do? Is that when you talk about, you know, the customer success, or is Koala more for businesses that have evolved a little bit more?
Yeah, such a good question. And so many things that you said resonated with me. So frankly, Koala customers range from founder teams to customer success teams of one, to teams where you have thousands of customers. And the reason why it works so well is it is really for teams that want to understand exactly how are our customers using our technology. I want to see what their usage behaviors look like. And I also want to capture important qualitative or narrative insights, normalize those insights over time, and understand how that affects overall customer health. And we talk about customer health, we're really talking about, is that customer going to have a lasting relationship with us? Are they going to continue renewing and using our platform year over year over year? So that's one big thing that really is the big thing that we provide teams, is a really deep understanding of the value that they're providing from a technology perspective, and the value qualitatively that's being provided as a result of their relationships, and then using that to expand the business. And, you know,
it's way cheaper to keep the clients you have than it is to go find new ones. And that's another form of value that needs to exist. It's, and by the way, you talk about finding value, if you're trying to build something big, your customer retention rate, your churn, I mean, those are going to become the hot topics after you actually find some people that are willing to pay for what you're offering. Yeah. So, you know, that's another form of value, is like, you know, it's one thing to drive someone in and get them to pay. It's another thing to keep them around. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're in a crowded world when it comes to startups and the internet and all these different things. And I wrote about this in my book, Million Dollar Bedroom. Like if you're doing anything that can be seen as successful, you immediately have people nipping at your heels to want to come be your competitor. And, you know, that's the same thing with, if you're not providing value, you know, like we say this to our clients at Full Scale, because they often in the beginning, they're hung up on hey, we really want to build that trust. We say, yeah, we get it. But you need to understand that if we're not providing value for you, you're not going to stick around as a client. That means I'm wasting my time right now, because the majority of our work is done in that couple weeks prior to them beginning, and then those first couple months, and then it kind of goes on autopilot. But there's a lot of things, and you talk about dealing with companies that have lots of different focuses, sizes, stages, resources, needs, and it's a different value prop for all of them. So, you know, that kind of stuff. I mean, overall, we went back to that whole, like, you know, the shopkeeper that doesn't want to open it. In your prior two startups, did you, looking back at them, did you launch them on time? Did you launch them too early, or did you actually wait too long?
Yeah. That's a good question. We launched early. And I think that actually was the best possible thing for us to do.
Well, then it wasn't early.
Exactly. Right.
Right.
I talked to founders today where, you know, the CEO or founder is like, I just need a few more features. I just need this sort of information on the market. I just need ... And my advice to them is always, you have enough. Get out there. You have enough. It usually comes from the perspective of them being too nervous about getting shut down. And for a lot of us, dealing with rejection is a muscle that you have to build. No one really loves rejection. I think we're a little bit, you know, early stage founders are masochistic in the way that we come to love it, because it means that you're getting a faster qualifier, right? You're moving down the pathway more quickly when you can get a no. And the no is in many cases just as valuable as a yes. So for first time founders, though, that muscle is new and it's not necessarily developed unless they're a founder or CEO that comes from a sales background. If they come from a sales, they have a sales background, they're strong in that area, they know what it's like to be rejected constantly, they move along, they don't care. If you have another background, you know, tech, marketing, operations, et cetera, it is difficult, I feel like, to prime or get that muscle ready to, you know, so that you understand what it's like to be rejected, you don't take it personally, you get some information and you move on. So, you know, my advice to first-time founders who are doing this is to get out there and just stop making excuses, really, and get out there, get the information, start pitching. You probably don't have, you know, 60% or 70% of what you wish you had, but the insights that you're going to learn from just getting out there in the field are going to pay back tenfold. And that's, I would say, is a really big piece of advice. So at Promobox, at Koala, we launched early, to your point, or right on time, depending on how we want to look at it. And we got a ton of good feedback. And look, we got a lot of no's. And if we hadn't had quickly shown off our product to get those no's, we wouldn't have had a good sense on where we ought to be headed. So if you wait until things are great and packaged and exactly how you envision them, your vision is likely not really what's needed in the market. So you have to be working much more nimbly so that if you build just a prototype or, you know, a demo or a beta, you can pivot more quickly rather than spending so much time on your live app that's now ready for launch and, you know, maybe is not really meeting the needs of your customer cohort. So I say, get out there. Yeah, and
in congress with creating value early, the reason that the early beta launch, a few tips for you. One, look, just set the expectations, you know, mm-hmm. on the way in. I mean, you can have a message say, hey, look, this is in beta. We want your feedback. We know mm-hmm. this isn't perfect. Help us get there. And it's a completely different, you can massage the point of view that the user has on the way in. Now, the reason that you create value for your company early is back to Gigabook, we waited too long on a couple mm-hmm. things, and I got obsessed with a few features that were important to me. Now, here's the thing. People don't buy features. They buy the benefits mm-hmm. of those. And then once we finally launched, what we quickly found is no one cared about mm-hmm. a couple of those things, which meant we wasted time and we wasted resource. And all of that is chalked up to what is commonly known as opportunity cost. Mm-hmm. And opportunity cost is the value of the foregone conclusion, which meant we could have, and in those cases, we could have kept the money in the bank. We could have launched earlier. But the reason that, you know, and we're talking now, you get a couple, you get to begin creating value with your future users or our partners or whomever, when you are looking for feedback, you're saying, hey, look, tell us what you really want. Now you're creating this invested kind of ownership with the mm-hmm. people, like, hey, look, these are problems that are real to me as your client, as your user, your client, your partner, your investor, maybe even your sales channel down the road. And it's like, oh, there's someone out there that cares about solving my issues. And if they begin to see you solving those problems, now you're chasing the money. Now, speaking of chasing money, it's a good time for me to go ahead and mention that today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Crown CFO, who offers fractional CFO services for businesses of any size or stage. Get the impact of a CFO for the fraction of a cost. You can visit crowncfo.com/hustle to learn more. I'm curious, have you ever used fractional services as you were building a business?
We have. So some fractional marketing resources, as well as on the financial side as well. I mean, you know, you're starting a company. In many cases, you can't afford to hire many full-time staff. A lot of times it's just, you know, a very small team or your co-founders or the, you know, OG owner. So yeah, right. I definitely have made use of those. And honestly, we kept a lot of our fractional talent years and years and years into the business. It's not like this is a year one or, you know, 0 to 6 months. Specifically, well,
they become advisory at some point. And, you know, part of whether you have a fraction, whether you hire someone full time or you have a fractional person is they, you have no choice but to pay a little bit to have them learn about what you do, how you do it, and how you could do it better. And, and, you know, it's, and this is not related to who our sponsor is. I think one of the ways you can provide a lot, create a lot of value for your company early is the use of things like fractional services. Creating advisory boards is another one. You know, you think about how, when, and where can you draw value for a portion of what it could cost on in other cases, or sometimes strategically. And, you know, I think that a lot of our early stage companies don't do is they all, they look at everyone that could be a quote user as like, it's almost like an adversarial. It's that like, hey, the they're a buyer or whatever. Like, honestly, you might find a very, very valuable partner, investor, or something along the lines by going out and trying to create some of these relationships and saying, hey, look, you know, this is something we're building for businesses like yours. Would you be interested in working with us early? And, you know, we're not going to, now here's the thing is you can't expect to have a huge amount of revenue, if any, from that. But that kind of input and value can very quickly put you in the driver's seat for a lot of stuff. Have you taken that approach with any of the three startups you've been involved with?
Yeah, specifically with Koala, actually. So I do a lot of my networking on LinkedIn, a significant amount. And I actually just had two calls this morning from people that I introduced myself to over LinkedIn. I don't know if it's a, I don't think it is, but it could be the fact that I am in a customer facing community, customer success. People in many cases are have that give first mentality and they're really open to networking. Founders are as well. There are specific cohorts of people that are really, really open to having those conversations. So I am regularly on LinkedIn looking for people that are in, you know, specific roles that I find will be interesting if I see that they have an intersection of experience between customer success and experience, or they have a background in sales and they move to customer success, or if they're a chief customer officer, I reach out and see if they're open to, you know, open and willing to have a conversation. I think what's important about these phone calls is that the process is the journey. These are not one call closes. They're really not even sales calls. They are honestly me having a thesis, sharing an idea, having a thought, asking for their, you know, a little bit about their background, how have they found this topic, or, you know, is what I'm saying resonating with them? We talk about the critical goals that they want to achieve next year. We talk about the things that they're most proud of achieving this year and how their tech stack has helped them do that or not helped them do that. I mean, I really have a list of go-to questions that I ask just depending on the vibe of the meeting, but I have largely built my network from, you know, my network outside of Boston, really from those efforts. And they've been amazingly, you know, an amazing amount or wealth of knowledge has come my way as a result of those conversations. You know, I have to say that at Promobox, I spent a lot of time in my own head. I questioned a lot of the ways that we were doing things. We're going to do that anyways, right? Especially being in early stage or as entrepreneurs. And I had a lot of input from our community on how other people were doing it, how they liked how we were doing it, how they thought we could improve how we're doing it. You're just, a ton of information is coming your way on how to get better, how to up your game. And as a result, I really turtled, essentially. I sort of went inside my own head and I stopped asking for a lot of feedback because it just felt very overwhelming. And, you know, we could definitely talk about how to manage all the feedback that comes our way as entrepreneurs, because it's worth the conversation. But while I was able to better cope with the role and the scaling of the company, I really put myself at a detriment when I was no longer widening the diversity of voice and my general community, you know, on a week to week basis, people that I was asking for feedback from and for advice from, and people have done this before, not done it before. And At Koala, I decided that with my next company, I did not want to do that. I wanted to ask for help as much as possible. I wanted to reach out. I wanted to have conversations with as many people as possible, because learning is something that I'm highly motivated by. And my, honestly, mental health.
Why did you back off? Did you back off? Because I think the default answer is we train ourselves to avoid negativity or things we don't want to hear. I mean, was that why?
Yeah, it was. I think, you know, it's a conversation for a therapist to probably dig into.
But we've thought about startup therapy. I mean, that should be a real thing. And that, and also exorcism.
Yeah.
There's got to be an exorcist somewhere that can get the demons out of our businesses. But yeah. I mean, but like you said, there's, you know, it might be for a therapist. And so some people begin to be, the reason I ask is a lot of people begin to become depressed about their, I mean, it's a founder's depression. We've done an episode on it. It's a thing. You can legitimately, you know, like you, it's like, you mentioned earlier with salespeople, if you're not used to hearing no, you start to believe it. And, you know, so was there a specific reason, or was it maybe, it could also just be bad habit. You know, we just have to check our own heads and say, oh man, so I always say you got to always check yourself and make sure you're being brilliant on the basics. Cause if you're not, you don't have a whole lot to build on past that.
I think it is probably two big things. One is that I didn't set appropriate boundaries. I let myself be completely defined by the company that I had helped create. And the lines were very blurred between who I was, who am I apart from the company that I'm creating? And who am I apart from this team that I'm building and nurturing? And also, you know, I am working with a ton of customers on a day-to-day basis, having, you know, anywhere from 15 to 20 calls a day, in addition to working with a team of 80 people. And so I think, first of all, it was the first time I was building a team that large. I didn't set healthy boundaries from a personal perspective. I really didn't have any personal time outside of, you know, trying to drive the company forward. And it led to burnout. I didn't take a vacation for 2 years at one point. And no one did that to me. I did it to myself. So part of me just completely stopped really going out and engaging with my community. And aside from meeting with customers and meeting with my team, no one really saw me. My husband hardly saw me. So I was, you know, I was doing what I thought I had to do to self-preserve, when really some more healthy boundaries would have been better for me, I believe now, than what I'm doing with Koala to set. I think the other thing too that I really struggled with was feeling like I didn't know if I had earned my right to sit at the table, to have a seat at the table. And I looked around. I am in a tech hub. I am constantly interacting with talent that has accomplished, in my mind, and truthfully, way more than I had on paper. And I was always wondering if I was about to say something super stupid. You know, I thought, I'm going to close my mouth, which is a good thing in many cases. And I'm going to, you know, work with our customers and with our team, and I'm focused on that. And I'm going to let everything else go. And
that's a way to not provide value early, is by clamming up. You know?
To be careful.
And we talked about this before we hit record as things to talk about. You're referring to imposter syndrome, which is that, like, am I an imposter? Do I really belong here? Do I really believe here? These are all things that are the deep seated causes of our own insecurities. And you know, you have to get past that, because also when you're working with a highly insecure mindset, you're also projecting that, whether you realize it or not. You are, you know, and that's the thing is you say, you know, you've mentioned that a couple of times. You used the phrase turtling up, and you said, I spent too much time in my own head. I've been there. I hate being in my own head. It's noisy as hell up there, and I'm like trying to calm it down a lot, because you know, people always say to me, they're like, oh, you have so much energy and all these ideas. I'm like, they're like, that must be great. I'm like, it sucks. Like, what do you mean? I'm like, 99% of these things I will never take any action on. I would love to quiet them down. But how'd you get over imposter syndrome then?
Yeah. I would say I'm still consistently working on it. But the things that have really helped me is letting go of other people's opinions of me and the work I am doing.
Hard to do.
It's very hard to do. Yeah, that's something I feel like I'll probably work on. Many of us will work on for the rest of our lives. I started, thinking of my situation as I can spend my lifetime trying to justify my experience, my skills, and my intelligence to other people, or I can let it go and spend my energy elsewhere, actually building a phenomenal business. So for me, it was one or the other. You can't choose both because you're spending your mental energy on something that doesn't matter. So I have let go of justifying myself to other people, really, in many cases, when it comes to building businesses. It is very liberating.
You know, there's a couple of things I want to point out. Well, first off, you're listening to someone that's a founder, two prior companies that had been highly successful, admit level of imposter syndrome or that feeling. And, so much of what we feel is important on this podcast is, and the feedback that we get from listeners is they love hearing about that stuff. And it's not because they enjoy watching us be personal train wrecks. It's because it makes them, our listeners, they hear successful people, they or we or whomever, I'm not going to say I'm successful on some days. Some days I'm on it. Some days I'm not. But it's important to remember that we all go through this. Like, it's not uncommon to, everyone has imposter syndrome at some table. And you got to get past it. Like, do you want to be at the table or not? Because you being concerned and hung up on that, it provides no value to the situation you're in, to your situation or anything else. It's difficult to get past. I mean, it really is. The struggle is real on some of that. And, that's not uncommon. And, I've gone through that with employees, with partners, with a lot of different people. And, you're going to limit your ability to create value in those situations. Now, with that, there is something that I found is those that want to often cast stones, the opinions that cloud your vision or create that weird resonance in your own head are usually given by people that have not, are not, and will not do the things that you've probably already done or are in the process of doing. So you got to really give some consideration to who you're hearing this input from, because once you start to analyze who it's coming from, you will find that you might not care about it anymore. And so many people that are out there, casting stones and shooting arrows are doing it from a different vantage point. And it's a lot of times it's their own insecurity that is making them say what they want. Instead of focusing on that, I highly recommend that you look up and see, because look, it's one thing to climb the mountain on your own. It's another thing to ask those on top to reach down and pull you up. And you'll find those are the people that you want to listen to, the people that are doing what you've wanted to do, how you've wanted to do it, or maybe who or any of it. And just ask, just ask, and you will be shocked at the paradigm shift that will occur after that, because you're going to go from listening to people that aren't where you're at most times, and instead looking up at people that can bring you up to the level that you want to be at. And, that's probably one of the things that everyone says, well, I don't care what everyone else says. Look, we all do. All of us care on some level. No one likes to hear anybody say bad crap about them. That's not like, there's probably someone somewhere that's a glutton for punishment in that regard. Now, but with that, and whether it's things you've done, another thing too, I think when it comes to creating value that you need to consider is if you're spending a lot of time staring in the rearview mirror, your eyes are not on the road in front of you.
Yeah.
And, I see a lot of people really diminish the value that they can create because they're obsessed. Like, look, if you made a mistake or you're currently making one and you know it, change it. It's, yeah. I mean, mistakes are mistakes until you fix them or stop doing them or move on with something. So,
yeah, I think it's worth talking about the intersection of value and sort of getting over the feeling of making a mistake or making a bad decision. One thing tactically that I've done that was a game changer for me that sort of brings those two together is that I was always worried about making a bad decision. And in many cases, there is no right or wrong when it comes to making that decision. And what I found was what was most helpful is that I put together 5 personal values that I hold. And we also put together our company values. And I found when I was trying to make a decision where I was flabbergasted on making, you know, what is the right path forward, I would go back to my value set for myself and for the company. And I would make a decision that was based on those values. It's much more powerful than a pros and cons list because then you're still worried about getting it wrong. When you make a value-based decision, you can really not be wrong because it is based on those values that you hold.
You have to share them now. You have to share them with us.
Oh, yeah. My personal ones are very, very free. I've shared them with my husband, actually. I'm still finding my voice.
I don't want you to share them on the personal level, but you know, all right. So in my book, Balance Me, I believe you have 3 categories: personal, professional, and physical.
Yeah.
You know, people are like life balance. Well, it's not just work and life. Like I believe there are 3 categories, and what your values are personally compared to professionally can be very different. Mm-hmm. However, they're all intertwined on some level. And like, you have 100% of your own value. That's or your own effort. And you know, if you look at, you can very quickly break it down. You can say, you know, let me ask. So personal, professional, or physical? Now, physical, there are things that you do. That's exercising, different kinds of stuff. If you have 100 points, where do they go? Like you have personal, professional, physical, once again. So where do you put those 100 points? Like just shooting from the hip.
Yeah. The big rock exercise.
Sure.
So when I was, it changes depending on the stage of the company, which is really interesting to me.
Well, I just meant in general for you, like Sansi's, like personal, professional, physical, because there's a difference between what is occurring and what you would like to occur. And that's where I'm going because, you know, we all have our own life and how we manage it. And then there's usually the way we'd like to do it. And there's a difference that it's not a zero sum game. It rarely, if ever, is the same.
Yeah. You make such a good point. Yeah. On the professional side, there are things like, my values are to be humble, or the company values are to be humble, to ask for help, to celebrate accomplishment, are 3 examples. On the, personal side, one is that I don't justify myself to others. That's something that's very important to me because we talked about, right? Then another one is to honor all beings. So just be a kind person that gives first. And then on the physical side, it is to, you know, it's funny. I didn't state any for physical, but for me, diet is very important. I find if I get the exercise, if I fuel myself with good quality nutrients, and if I get the sleep that I need, that things tend to fall into place. So those
are not going to argue with. I'm not going to argue with you there. And by the way, at Full Scale, the rumor is that I never sleep. And it's because I don't. I sleep way less than I probably should. But yeah, so that's. I mean, that's. Now you talk about creating value. If you don't, and actually, by the way, the answer I was looking for is typically would take 100% of our effort. For me, it would be like 70. It's like right now, it's about 70% professional, 20% personal. Maybe 10% physical.
I see. Yeah,
just a simple like taking you got 100% of your own effort. Now, if I really wanted to, that's my current reality, my current situation. What is different is my desired situation. So I'd rather see the professional part be down around 50, and you know, like do some different stuff now. That by the way, that balance is different for everyone because having written a book that kind of starts with that, it has a comparison there. People, well, what's the ideal number? I don't know.
It's who knows?
Everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, because one person's not going to be happy with one, you know, with one of those, you know, alignments, and the other person would be, but you can compare the two. So you have your current situation and your desired situation, and you can literally, I mean, that's like that old, like Ben Franklin T graph, you know, let's put the pros on one side and the cons on the other, and you can compare, like where they add up. And in that situation, you know, like you said, it's sometimes to step away and take a step back can be the greatest way that you can begin to provide value. Because, you know, you get, you also talk about if you're in those roles of business development and places you hear no, it's easy to believe that doors are constantly slamming in your face. Now, the thing is if the door is an inch from your face, you can't really tell me that you're not standing in a hallway full of open doors. So sometimes you just got to take a step back. You got to look around a little bit, see what's up. And, you know, I'm just a huge fan of tuning up anything, you know, like there's so many things that, you know, like I could put out like all the shit I do wrong on a normal and recurring basis and like all of the terrible things that I need to fix in my own, you know, habits. And those are the things, but if you're not aware of them, you know, like I said, if you can't, my thesis statement here is if you can't begin to provide value for yourself, then it becomes very difficult to provide value for those around you, including the business, your coworkers, your own family. So, So we got philosophical and in this episode, you know, so hopefully those of you that are listening, you know, like, We're gonna stare into crystals after this and predict our own future, perhaps. I don't know. We'll see what happens. Now, you know, before we get into the founder's freestyle, and you know, we end our episodes of Startup Hustle where we get into making a key point. You can really say whatever you want, but you can also find a link to Sansi's current company, Koala, and that is cleverly spelled with a Q-U-A. You can learn more about it by clicking that link and go check it out, because it is a company built all around creating and providing value for yourself and your clients. Now, as promised, we end our episodes with the founder's freestyle. So overall, if you had to make one statement or something along the lines of how to create value in the early stages, what are you leaning on?
Give first.
Give?
Give first. Yep. If you're going to do anything, provide some value before you ask for anything. It's the easiest way to forge or build relationships, to get information, to grow your company. It's your personal network is giving.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm going to actually parlay off of that. You know, there's so many different phrases or things that look at this principle. And, you know, I say you have to make a deposit before you can make a withdrawal. And by not giving first or offering to provide value or do something, if you're asking for some kind of return, you are literally like someone that is standing at the teller window of a bank that they don't have an account at, and you're saying, "Hey, let me get $50," and they're like, "You haven't made any deposits here, ma'am or sir," and it's the same thing. So I actually, and I normally don't do this. What are a couple simple ways to? And I mentioned a couple. But what are a couple things that you've learned about how to give first?
There are really small tactical things that I do in an effort. And then, you know, well, I'll start with the smaller ones. And I mentioned I do a lot of my networking over LinkedIn if I'm trying to expand my network. So things that I do, if I ask to connect, I usually state what maybe I can provide. I notice that they have a background that's similar to my background, or maybe it's different in how it might be, you know, helpful for us to connect and what we're looking to learn. I endorse them usually after our conversations on LinkedIn. It's a really easy way to give them kudos and say thanks. If you talked about leadership, if you talked about SaaS, if you talked about building whatever it is, you can go on there and endorse them on LinkedIn. It's a few clicks of a button and it's really easy. I make a lot of introductions as well. So I always ask, thanking them for providing time and mentioning that I have a really large network and I'm happy to introduce them to someone that or someone in a specific role that they're looking to chat with. So those are some of the small things I do to try to give first, in addition to the regular stuff that we all know about, where it's sharing a piece of content or a video of something you know that they're interested in, et cetera.
I mean, the content, and those are, there's a reason that those were fourth, fifth, or sixth on the list, and you didn't mention those. I mean, you know, talking about, well, stating what kind of value you can provide is a great way to lead into a conversation. Like, because, you know, you look at LinkedIn, and I'm connected to 23,000 people on LinkedIn, and it feels on some days as if all of them are sending me messages. Yeah. So, you know, it's like the question, it's like, and you don't provide value by saying, I noticed that we have a lot of connections in common, and I'd really love to talk to you about how. So what that said is, I see you know a lot of people I'd like to know. I'd really like to figure out how I can get you to make that make sense for me. That's not a great lead, you know, and like what Sansi's mentioning, well, an example could be, you know, like, all right, so if I reached out and made a connection to someone that ran a venture capital firm, I'd say, you know what, I talked to a lot of the clients that we work with at Full Scale, as well as the guests that I have on Startup Hustle, are people I think you'd really want to talk to. Not all of them, but some of them. And I'd like to have a conversation about that. Now, all of a sudden, now there's interest. And remember that the world's most popular radio station is WIIFM, which the call letters for that stand for What's In It For Me. It is actually what everyone's tuned into. So you need to be broadcasting on that network. You know, and that's how you get people's attention. I mean, some of the other things you talk about, endorsements and intros, all of these things we mentioned, none of which cost any money to do. They're all about your effort, your time, and your focus, but try to make them matter and try to make them meaningful. That's all I have to say. Thanks for joining me, Sansi. I'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.
Yep.
Startup Hustle's brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.